That is Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, performed by Jeff Buckley, who died on this day in 1997 at the age of 30. Yes, we always honor the music in between our segments here, the music of the day on this day in history. And we are now talking about something very tragic that happened on this day in history, which was the passing of one of just one of the greatest human beings on the planet Earth, Maya Angelou. And before I introduce our really esteemed panel, Dr. Kay Whitehead joins us, and the great poet Alpha Michael Weaver joins us, we are going to hear the part of our conversation that I had with Tavis Smiley yesterday, author, political commentator, host of PBS's Tavis Smiley, as we talk about his intense and powerful relationship that he had with Maya Angelou. What do you think Maya Angelou meant for America? What did she mean for America?
She was iconic, and that's a word, Mark, that we overuse, but iconic when you consider where she started and where she ended. And isn't that true for all of us? It's not so much where you start in life, it's where you end. Not so much about your altitude, but your attitude. Of course, it takes the right attitude to climb the heights that she climbed, and you figure that she grows up in Stamps, Arkansas, and for years, as you know, she was unable to talk. And years later, of course, she wrote about that experience in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, goes on to be an international bestseller. But she doesn't just learn how to sing. She learns how to talk. She learns how to talk and how to sing and how to dance and how to write and how to act and how to produce. She was in that classic series, that saga Roots, the Alex Haley series. She starred in that, directed an episode of that. So she, you know, of course, the poem On the Pulse of Morning she did at Bill Clinton's inauguration. She's an American that reminds us that when you dream big and you work hard, you can accomplish things, even in a country where that kind of success is not designed for you.
You know, it made me also think of people like Maya Angelou also speak to what I think is going on, like the redefinition of America. You know, when the Civil Rights Movement was going on, people were fighting for integration, and people started asking the question, integrate into what? Right. So, and in some ways, Maya Angelou was at the forefront of redefining America and redefining even what that might mean.
No doubt about it. And in her lifetime, she had the unique opportunity, the unique experience of both befriending Malcolm X and Dr. King. That tumultuous period that you're talking about, where Malcolm had one view and Martin had another view, Maya was so adept and sought after in terms of her intellect and insights that she ends up befriending both Malcolm and Martin, and speaks at the service of both of them. She speaks at Martin's service and Malcolm's service. And years later, of course, Dr. King is assassinated on April 4th, which happens to be Maya's birthday. So as her life went on, even her birthday didn't mean the same, because every year she had to celebrate her birthday with this horrible backdrop of King being assassinated on her birthday. In that poem that she delivered at Bill Clinton's inauguration, On the Pulse of Morning, there's a line to your brilliant analysis, Mark, that speaks to all of us. And the line says, speaking specifically of African Americans, that we were bought, stolen, sold into slavery, arriving here on a nightmare, praying for a dream. And isn't that what we're dealing with right now with this immigration debate? There's so many persons who immigrated to this country. I'm sitting in New York right now as we talk, not in my hometown of L.A., but in New York on business. New York is the ultimate city, you know, that has been populated and built by immigrants as they did this country. And here we are, you know, in this ugly, nasty, vitriolic, seems to be going nowhere immigration debate. And Maya's words ring loud and clarion this morning, today, that so many people are still arriving here on a nightmare, praying for a dream. That's what makes America a great nation, and Maya had that experience, and look what she was able to become, and look what she gave to all of us, because she was given the opportunity to be her best self. And we ought to be reminded of that as we have these kinds of facile debates about what kind of nation we really want to be.
Tavis, I'm finally just on Maya Angelou. Could you tell our listeners, because I know people don't realize this about you and your personal relationship with Maya Angelou, it was more than just somebody interviewing her for you.
Yeah, as a child, you know, I admired her and, you know, read her works and memorized some of her poems. My favorite to this day. She has written so much great stuff. But as a kid, as a black kid growing up, born in Mississippi, talking about myself now, growing up in Mississippi. She grew up in Arkansas. I'm raised in Indiana in the Midwest. A black kid from a big family, 10 kids. We're very poor. I grew up in a three-bedroom trailer with one bathroom. Me and my seven younger brothers in one bedroom, my two sisters and my grandmother, Big Mom, in the second bedroom, my mother and father in the third bedroom, 13 people, three-bedroom trailer, one bathroom. That's how I grew up in those kind of impoverished conditions. And so when I got to read this poem that she wrote called Still I Rise, that poem just said so much to me about the capacity I had within me if I worked hard to rise even from those conditions. I learned that poem backwards and forwards, and it stuck with me. And I read her works and Gwendolyn Brooks' works, and those poems just meant so much to me. And at one point when I was a child, I used to write poetry. I haven't done it in years, but she kind of inspired me to get my own thoughts out on paper. And then imagine, you know, you fast forward a few years, and I'm all of 19 or 20, and on my very first trip to Africa, I'm taken to the continent by Maya Angelou. I knew her through a mutual friend. I got to go to Africa with her for about 2 weeks, and one of the greatest joys of my life, Mark, was just following behind her, literally carrying her bags everywhere we went for those 2 weeks and sitting at her feet and listening and learning and laughing and loving. And then while we were there, she gave a series of lectures at the Du Bois Institute. You know, W.B. Du Bois, later in his life, left America, kind of gave up on it, and moved to Accra, Ghana, and that's where he lived and died. There's an institute there on the grounds where he lived. It's a museum and an institute and other things. And so it's a sacred place, and it's where he died. And Maya Angelou lectured there. And those lectures that she gave over those two or three days still ring in my spirit to this day. But I've been to 16 or 17 African countries now, including traveling with Bill Clinton and other dignitaries. But there is no trip that I will ever remember like the very first trip to the African continent when I carried Maya Angelou's bags around for 10 days.
Well, she was both a mentor, a friend, a teacher, and somebody very special to you, Tavis Smiley. I appreciate your remembrance of her.
Thank you for talking about it.
We're going to continue our conversation, our thinking about Maya Angelou here on the Mark Steiner Show. And on the way, we let you know that we'll talk with these two wonderful people who are in our studio now. Dr. Kosonia Wise Whitehead is assistant professor of communication and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Pardon me. Her new book is Notes from a Colored Girl: The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. And we are joined by Afa Michael Weaver, who is on our show one more time, a great poet, a Baltimore native, currently lives in Somerville, Massachusetts, and who won the one of the biggest prizes in poetry just recently, the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, as we continue our thinking about the great Maya Angelou. And good to have you with us, Kay.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I understand Michael's not on the phone just yet, but he will be in a minute. Mm-hmm. You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can email us at steinershow@gmail.com, as I said, or tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We want you to bring us your thoughts about Maya Angelou. And I think that Maya Angelou, and I think that you know, it's Kay, she's it's almost hard to figure out where to begin, because her life story was so powerful. She covered so many places. At the beginning of our last hour, when we talked about race and NPR, Dr. Jared Ball made a comment. He said we should ask, when we played her singing the Calypso song,
yes,
she sang, that we should ask a trivia question: what if Louis Farrakhan and Maya Angelou have in common? They were both Calypso singers in the 50s. But please.
I think it's difficult to try to sum her up in just one word. I think she transcended life. I think she was bigger than what we could ever imagine. She was a powerful figure. And I think there are certain people in history that have the ability to go beyond race and to go beyond gender and to go beyond class and really connect with people from everywhere, connect to the hearts of people. And when I think about the life and the legacy of Dr. Maya Angelou, that's what I think about, being larger than life, being able to start in these incredible, difficult situations. Tavis Smiley did allude to it, the fact that she did not speak for almost 5 years. She made that choice. She was afraid of the power of her own words. And during that time when she wasn't speaking, based upon what had happened to her in the home, She read books. She memorized poetry. She said she found herself in those moments. And I think it's amazing to think that you can have this very difficult moment and rise out of that to be better than that situation, to be more than that situation, more than what people thought she would be. In fact, because she didn't speak for almost 5 years, members of her family thought that perhaps she was stupid, that she'd never learn how to speak, or she would never speak again. And when she did speak, finally, she spoke volumes.
The reason that you made that the story about my answer not speaking and that came out in her autobiography, one of her 7 autobiographies,
yes,
that she wrote, a whole series of things that are just amazing. You can actually, they're now in one volume. You can read all the 100 pages that just roll through in her work. But she didn't speak because when her father, who was a fairly abusive kind of man, mm-hmm, took her back from her grandmother, who had done very well with her general store, back into poverty, gave her back to her mother.
Yes.
That her mother's boyfriend raped her.
Yes.
And after she was raped, the man did not go to jail. He was let out of prison and was kicked to death, people think, beaten to death by
her
family members, perhaps.
Yes.
Perhaps. She doesn't even know. But it was at that moment that she went silent.
Because she was afraid. She thought that what she said had killed him.
And she, but it also began when she just sort of just did anything about the power of words.
Yes.
And we're now also joined by Alpha Michael Weaver, one of America's great poets and a Baltimore native who now lives in Somerville, Massachusetts, and of course just won the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. And congratulations again for that, Alpha Michael Weaver. How are you? Oh, did we just lose him again on the phone? We'll pick him back. Oh, Michael, you're there. Great. So congratulations once again for your award, the Kingsley Tufts Award.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. Thank you.
So we were just talking about Maya Angelou, but that time that she remained silent as a child, and she was known as a poet, but she did so many things. And I just give us your reflections for America on what she meant for us.
Well, I think she was, as I was saying on WDBH here in Boston yesterday, she presented a moral platform and framework for African American people, but extending beyond that to many populations. And she had a global stage. She was remarkably inspiring, but also her life spanned about 75% of the 20th century. You know, when she published that memoir in 1969, she was 41 years old.
Right.
She'd already known James Baldwin as a friend. That's a remarkable lifespan.
She went through a lot, and in that she was almost, people maybe overuse this term, almost Zelig-like in the places that she ended up and where she was. I mean, meeting Malcolm X in Ghana when she went there with the man that she lived with, who South African freedom fighter, with her son to go to the University of Ghana when he was hurt there, and stayed in Ghana, and meeting Martin Luther King, and then she was going to work with the OAAU with Malcolm X, and then he was assassinated. And she was going to work for Martin Luther King in 1968 with the Poor People's Campaign, and he was assassinated. I mean, the moments that she lived through. She danced. She had a duo with Alvin Ailey that never became famous, but I mean,
danced together.
They danced together back in the 50s. I mean,
yeah, she had a remarkable trajectory, and sometimes I think that she was propelled by there were a set of threads that came out of the fact of her recovering from a rather serious child trauma, and I think that trajectory combined with her courage. I mean, she operated a streetcar in San Francisco, I believe, when she was very young.
Right.
She was very somewhat precocious even, you know.
But she had this strength about her as well. When you think about, if you go back and you read both the first and the second autobiography, where she talks about her work running a business, you know, with prostitution and being a restaurant cook, and you take a look at the grit that she had, understanding that what was happening around her did not define who she was going to be, that she kept redefining herself, whether she redefined herself as a dancer, and when that didn't really go anywhere, then she redefined herself as a writer, like all of these processes and moments of redefining who you are and the statement you want to make to the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in 1969, when the first memoir was published, that was the year of my 18th birthday. I was 17 for most of that year. And encountering her work at that time was really important for me. The 1960s, and for someone who was an adolescent at that time, was a very confusing and challenging time in history.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had someone like Maya Angelou come along, and I read her memoir at the same time that I read Malcolm X's autobiography.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, they gave me a framework for looking out on the world from East Baltimore, which was really important to me.
I was in Washington, D.C. I was 16 when I received I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I remember because I was laying on my bed crying about the fact that I was a teenager and I was crying over some boy. And my mother comes in and she brings this book by Maya Angelou. She lays it on the bed and she says, read this. It will remind you of who you are. It will give you light and it will teach you how to sing.
I had a wonderful teacher who later went on to become chair of political science at Howard University and then had a tragic death. Many people thought he was murdered as he was organizing people in North Carolina, Mick McGuire. It was just an amazing guy and taught us African history and was my dear friend and professor. And he's the one who gave me Why Caged Bird Sings to read. And we did a course around new literature. And then it was so think about it now. This is 2014. That was a course in new literature, right?
But I think for young people, they're still being introduced to it. I think that's one of the things about Maya Angelou's work, that young people can read. I gave I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings to my 13-year-old son. I said, I want you to take it, read it slow. There's a lot of information in here, but we can unpack this together. And we could talk about what it means not to end up where you started. I also gave him a copy of Malcolm X's autobiography. I said, these are books to have on your shelf because they will remind you that you can rewrite your story any way that you want it to be written.
Yeah, absolutely. You can rewrite it. And they also give you, they give young African-American people a set of critical lenses to look out onto the world. And, you know, I particularly think of them in terms of the, you know, the stream of the tradition and the culture of overcoming just really incredible odds, going all the way back to Frederick Douglass and, you know, Harriet Jacobs. It's just an incredible legacy, but then they carry that on. And Maya Angelou was born 1 year before my mother and 6 years after my father, so she's certainly my parents' generation.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yes.
Very accessible, and you can really identify with her.
She was the also people. I think many people don't realize that she was the first black woman to write a screenplay produced into a major movie as well. When she wrote this movie, Georgia, Georgia, right?
Right.
Which is breaking new boundaries. I think people don't know that about her, and that's why I think, and that's what concerned me yesterday when the news broke, and so Twitter exploded, and social media all over the world talking about Maya Angelou and trying to capture her in just a quote or two, that they really don't understand the fullness of her life, going all the way back to not just her poetry, but going back to 1977. I remember when she was in the Roots movie, and my father was so happy to see her. He's standing up, and he's applauding. And I'm like, who is this woman? He said, oh, no, when genius comes into your midst, you have to recognize genius. And so she's part of my father's genius. To my father, she's like a sister. To me, she's like an auntie.
Uh-huh.
You know, this regal woman giving advice. But to those that grew up with her and came of age with her, she's like a sister who just kept moving forward. You have these threads, but she kept finding ways to connect the threads. I think it's interesting that King, of course, was assassinated on her birthday, and she said at that point she stopped celebrating her birthday. And instead, every year she would send flowers to Mrs. King instead. That this is not my day anymore. This is now your day, so we can remember him together.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's also very significant that we've lost her a week or so after Dr. Vincent Harding.
Yes, yes.
Who wrote There Is a River, and we're losing these icons rather, you know, one after another. Mary Baraka's gone. And but also with Maya Angelou, as an actress, you know, she understood presence. You know,
mm-hmm.
she had, as you said, that regal bearing about her and an energy, and, you know, a good actor understands voice and diction and poise and gesture. I mean, when you see her on film, they're like, you know, the screen just comes alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, she understood those things, and she used them with a certain wisdom, and also she was, you know, she was of that generation that was really concerned about black people and had that generosity and a very complex humility also, you know, because as an actor, you can't be a welcome mat, but you also have to understand, you know, what you're doing, you know. And she understood those things. She had a kind of, when it comes to performance and presence, she had a kind of perfect pitch, you know.
And, she absolutely did. I was thinking, when I was talking to my producers this morning as they were preparing for today's program here early this morning, and I was going through thinking about her, and I was just going through some biographical stuff again, and I realized something that I never realized until this moment, which is really, I'm trying to picture it now in my head. When I was a little kid, it's 1961, I was, 15? And I was a civil rights movement worker here, and a bunch of people from the Civic Interest Group, which was part of SNCC here in Baltimore, we decided, they said, we're going to go to New York and see this play. And they said, can you come with us? I said, yeah, I'll come. So I went with them. I was a little, you know, always tagging along, a little teenage boy tagging along. And we went to see The Blacks by Genet.
Yes.
And in it, I remember James Earl Jones, all these figures were in it. But it wasn't until this morning, when I'm writing this stuff up about Maya Angelou, I said, she was in that play.
those moments of connection. I've met Maya Angelou twice. I met her in 1999, and I had just won the Langston Hughes Poetry Award from the Gwendolyn Brooks Center. And she was at the awards ceremony, and she came up. I was introduced to her. And I remember that she gave me a hug. And she said, keep writing, baby. The world needs your words to make us a little bit better. And I wrote it in the front cover of my journal, and I have it hanging on my wall at home to just remind me of that moment with her. I met her again in 2002. I was pregnant with my second son, and I think she probably heard me complaining across the room. I'm complaining about being tired and the struggles of being a woman and keeping the movement going forward. And I remember asking her, I said, can you give me some advice on how you can keep going when everything in you wants to stop? And I was holding a copy of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, that copy my mother gave me when I was 16. She took the book from my hand and she wrote the word joy in huge letters and signed her name and said, do everything with that and everything will get done. And I remembered that. I was thinking about that this week, going, do everything with joy. And that to me is how she lived her life, with an incredible smile and incredible laughter. You said that we're losing these icons. Thanks to social media and YouTube, we're not. You can go online and you can see clips of Maya Angelou right. and Amiri Baraka. You can go in, you can see some of her plays. You can hear her read poetry. Physically, she's gone, but she's still with us, and people can now discover her again.
Yeah, I was watching her on a children's program singing the song My Name Is My Name, I believe. I've forgotten the title of the song, but just watching her on the video, there were two kids with her. They were singing this song about how glorious their names are. And it was just watching them, it was uplifting. she, there she was with two kids, and for her 80th birthday, she was on NPR, and she was talking about how she gets God's attention. She says, well, this is me, and black and female, et cetera. She knew how to seize the moment. And I think a lesson there, there is a lesson there for everyone, which is to understand where you are at any given moment and to be alive. I mean, she lived her life in the sense of being totally alive, and having a certain faith in her own generosity.
Mm-hmm.
As next she did when she encouraged you about your writing, she had a faith in her own generosity.
Right. And a faith in her own story. I think one of my favorite stories about Maya Angelou is when somebody challenged her on contradictions in her own life story. They said, there's so many contradictions. You have all these things that you say happen. And the answer, and of course I'm paraphrasing, but she said, everything I write is true whether it happened or not. It's true to me because this is how I remember it and how I interpret it. I like that claiming of your story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And in terms of her memoir and memoirs in general, the way the mind and memory work,
I mean,
it's just as she said.
Right.
It's just as she said. I mean, how many of us can say exactly what we did yesterday all 24 hours?
We actually, before as we go out of here in just a few minutes, and we have queued up on the what you were just talking about, My Name from Sesame Street. Mm. We'll hear a little bit of that. And we're going to do and if it's not from this, and we have to leave, we'll play as we come back to the next segment some more of Maya Angelou. And I just want to, just this is something that I was just thinking about, that she, the great pieces she wrote, A Song Flung Up to Heaven. And it's pieces I pulled out of here. I didn't actually pull these out. I found them in someone's article, and they pulled it out for me, which is great, in the New York Times. Elizabeth Alexander's article this morning, I pulled it out of there. And it was a great poet in her own right, and also spoke at the inauguration. When Maya Angelou told her that, darling, I'm not coming. I'm staying home and drinking a bottle of wine and eating my own potage. I've been there. So I watch it on television. So she... But she wrote, how did it happen that we could nurse a nation of strangers, be maids to multitudes of people who scorned us, and still walk with the same majesty and stand with a degree of pride? We had come so far from where we started, and we weren't nearly approaching where we had to be, but we were on the road to becoming better.
Mm. Oh, wonderful. Mm.
Wow.
And that really says a great deal about who she was
and
what she's saying.
Yeah. And the work she did as a writer, she said that good writing is hard. I remember when someone once said to her, oh, I want to be a writer. She says, do you write every day? They said no. She said, then you don't want to be a writer, because good writing is hard and it takes a long time to do. So when I read her words, I know that even though she has this beautiful line that leaps off the page, how many hours did it take to get that? And you know this as a poet, Mr. Weaver. How many hours does it take to get that one line that leaps off the page into someone's spirit? And she did that quite often.
Yeah, how many hours of writing and how many years of living, you know?
Right.
Really? As you say, the more bottom you have to you, the more. Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us in this part of, and Tavis Smiley earlier for joining us to talk about Maya Angelou in this segment of our program. And we'll come back to sometimes with a long, even longer segment. I would probably ask Alpha Michael Weaver and Dr. Kay Whitehead to come back and maybe bring some of their favorite pieces and some others to read what they think, and we'll play some of her words. Think about her and to let you all do that with us. I would love that if you have the time.
That would be wonderful. Wonderful.
Sure, it would be, yes.
Alpha Michael Weaver, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate you taking the time.
No, thanks to both of you. Nice to talk.
And Kay Whitehead, always great to have you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Anytime. It's my pleasure.
And our next conversation has to be for your new book, Notes from a Color Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. I look forward to reading that.
Thank you.
This is the great Maya Angelou singing my name on Sesame Street.
And I say it proudly, Maya is